The husband and wife had been married for over 40 years, but their time together on this earth was drawing to a close because she had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. The couple was determined, though, to walk this final journey together. When she set her alarm every morning for 2:30 a.m. to take her medicine, he woke with her. And because neither of them could fall back asleep right away, they decided to make something of a ritual of it. They decided that each night after she took her pill, they would read to one another from the Psalms. One psalm per night. One night he read aloud to her, the next night she to him. And so it went until they came to the 88th psalm. He scanned the text in silence and decided maybe it would be better to skip ahead to 89. No, she insisted. Read it. It's what I need to hear right now. So he read to her aloud the psalm.
O Lord God of my salvation, when at night cry out in your presence, let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to the pit. Every day I call on you, O Lord. I spread out my hands to you. Do you work wonders for the dead? Is your steadfast love declared in the grave? Are your wonders known in the darkness, or your saving help in the land of forgetfulness? But I cry out to you, O Lord, in the morning. My prayer comes before you.
When he finished reading, he turned out the light and they closed their eyes. This poignant encounter between a couple living in death's shadow and a sacred text illustrates for me the complicated nature of our relationship to grief. Notice the husband's gentle effort to spare his wife from the sorrow of the psalm. He's trying to protect her. But notice, too, the wife's insistence that he go ahead and read it. It's what I need to hear, she said. And notice, finally, how the psalmist doesn't hold anything back, how he cries out in despair, confronting God, almost accusing God with his suffering. We often don't know what to do with grief, our own or others. We're not sure how to cope with all the powerful emotions that come up when we grieve, the anger, the sorrow, the regret, the guilt. And so rather than deal with all these painful feelings, we suppress them, we try to push them down or ignore them, and in so doing, we become unsuspecting participants in what I sometimes call the conspiracy against tears. The conspiracy against tears. Courtney Davis confesses that she was one such co-conspirator. Davis is a nurse practitioner, someone who sees a lot of tears in the eyes of a young man who's lost a limb or a widower leaving the hospital with the clothes of his deceased wife. Early in her career, Davis writes, when I saw people crying, I'd want to ease their sadness with cheer and consolation. I'd hug the patient and tell her, try and get pregnant next month. I'd reassure the widower, your wife had a long life. I'd enter the burned child's room in intensive care with a smile, rather than encourage the mother to weep in my arms. For Davis, part of it was simply a hazard of the profession. Isn't it a nurse's job, after all, to make people feel better, to make them healthy? Tears can feel like an indictment of a caregiver, a sign that they've failed in their task. But Davis acknowledges that part of it was simply her own discomfort with grief, a discomfort that she didn't discover until the person who was dying was not a patient, but her own mother. When my own mother died, I was terrified and confused, she writes. Was I allowed to be the grieving daughter? Or should I be the competent caregiver? I held my mother's wrist, counting her pulse as it slowed. After her last breath, I rang the nurse. Heart pounding, I waved goodbye to my mother, her gray hair bright against the sheets. And I said in the cheery voice I'd practiced all my life, bye, Mom. I didn't know that I could have climbed into bed with her and wept. Davis sees it differently now. Now she appreciates the value of grief and gives her patients the space and permission they need to grieve how they must. I believe that grief fully expressed, she says, changes over time into something less overpowering, even granting us a new understanding, a kind of double vision that comprehends both the beauty and fragility of life at the same time. Today, I want to suggest that our tears themselves are broken hallelujahs, expressions of both lament and praise. Perhaps we haven't considered how our tears testify to all that we value and hold precious in the world, how they speak not only to the brokenness that we feel in the moment that we shed them, but to the wholeness that we've glimpsed and cherished, however briefly. And in this sense, aren't our tears almost like offerings upon the altar of life's preciousness, singing of what we have loved?
Have you ever seen a jazz funeral or a second line parade? You know that life mingles with death, that there is a sorrow right in the midst of raucous joy, that music is the medium that transports and binds us. They get it right in New Orleans, in lifting death into the cycle of living, reminding us that the wheel keeps turning, and it is all part of the same sacred circle. Don't hold on to the fear that drains you. Restore and embrace whatever sanity brings you life. And do it now. Because this is the only time you know for sure that you possess. Blessed be.